Hey, friends. To be fair, life can feel like a mess with too little time. But on this podcast, we think through the challenges and make thoughtful, everyday decisions. My name is Amy Kay, and this is To Be Fair. Thank you so much for listening today. This is episode number 6 of To Be Fair, and today we're thinking about our life's vision and its unfolding. As always, there is a doable thing suggested in this episode, but to be fair, this is more of a big picture episode than others have been so far. I hope you'll stay with me for a bit and see what you think, and I certainly hope it's helpful to you. One of my favorite hymns is, "Be Thou My Vision." "Be Thou My Vision, O Lord of my heart," it begins. The hymn has its origins almost 1,500 years ago in Ireland. It was probably written by a 6th century Irish poet. Monks chanted poetry, and this poem specifically, and eventually it was published in a couple of Irish manuscripts in the 8th century. It was translated into prose in the early 1900s, and was then paired with a traditional Irish tune for a hymnal in 1919. From there, it's a story of legendary hymns. It was included in a number of British hymnals, and after World War II, hymnal editors in the United States learned of it. Now it is standard in most hymnals and has been recorded by many musicians. The reason I say all of this is because this is a hymn that is not just important to me. It has been meaningful to people for literally 1,500 years. The song is popular because it resonates, I think. It's a prayer that God will be our vision, our best thought, our presence, our light. I like this hymn very much because God is very much my vision as a person of faith and as one who follows Christ. It's totally okay if we are different in this way, but God is my vision, so I'm going to say God. But please hear in your head whatever name or expression of source is right for you as your core. Maybe it's eternal connectedness or presence. Whatever it is, hear what is right for you when I say God. So if God is my vision, the next question is certainly like, what is of God? I need to know that so I know how I should live my life. So I look to the Bible for authority here. And instead of going right to Jesus, I'm going to pull it back to the Old Testament today. It doesn't get enough play. And the prophets were some crazy characters, and they're worthy of our time. So we're going back to the prophets. My professor, Dr. John Brockie, used to say in seminary that there was a litmus test to show if kings were good or bad in the eyes of the prophets. If the kings took care of the poor and the weak, they were blessed in the eyes of God. They were good kings. If they did not take care of the poor, they were on the crap list of kings. They were not blessed by God. Dr. Brockie said it a little bit differently than that, a little more eloquently, I'm sure, but that's how I internalized it, and, you know, that's the bottom line there. Crap list, good list. Dr. Brockie is a scholar of the prophet Jeremiah, so it was awesome to get to learn about Jeremiah in seminary from him. And there is this really compelling story of a father and son who were both kings, one after the other, in Jeremiah 22. Josiah was the dad, and he was followed by the son Jehoiakim. This was around 600 before Jesus' time. Josiah was a noble and good king in the writings. The way Jehoiakim was described, he was worse than a dishonored dead donkey. Literally like a dead donkey that was tossed out of the city like trash. That was the son. And here's the difference between the two, the good dad, the bad son. Jehoiakim, the son, used forced labor to live the life of the rich and famous back in the day. He dealt in cedar, which had to be imported because cedars didn't grow where he lived. And think of transporting cedar in the ancient days. What a mess. He had a two-story dwelling, and there wasn't scaffolding units to be rented from big box stores in those days. It was painstaking for the forced laborers to build that mansion of a place with windows on the second floor, no less, and then to make the dwelling a color of deep red, which also had to be imported from distant lands. This is a high maintenance king using slave laborers. And Jehoiakim didn't get a lot of peer pressure to change how he was enslaving his own people by the other kings of his day, because there were lots of them in the ancient Near East who were also using slave laborers. Like, it was the thing to do. It was the common practice. But that didn't make it right. And the people in Jerusalem knew a God who had freed them from slavery in Egypt. Like, those were their people, the ones who were slaves, and then they were freed by God. And so these people didn't care if it was common practice to enslave people to build mansions. It was not of their God. King Josiah, the dad, had been countercultural. He had nice things too, right? He was a king, but he didn't use slave laborers to get it. He died an honorable death, and the people mourned. His son should have taken a lesson or two, but he was an oppressor. And when he died, he was dragged off and thrown out beyond the gates of Jerusalem like the dead ass he was. The prophets weren't messing around, friends. There was no sugarcoating here. They knew what it was and what it was not to be a person of God. God blessed the ones who cared for the most poor and the weak. That was behavior that was of God. And there's lots of stories like this in the Bible that are so interesting and so telling. And for Christians, you know, there was Jesus, who certainly had a lot to say about how we care for the least of these. And because I'm a Christian and understand the world through my faith, I feel called to take care of the poor and the oppressed, and to do so with love and grace for everyone and for myself too. And I certainly feel called to care and love my boys in the present moment and forevermore. That's me. That's all me. But what about you? What is your source, my friends? Whose are you, perhaps? Or what is your connection? And here's the tangible thing for today. What does that mean for your most perfect vision of your unfolding life? What does your understanding of God, or whatever you hold central to your being, what does that understanding mean for your most perfect vision of life, of your unfolding life? And I'm not being cheesy here. I mean, you might think I'm being cheesy, I guess, but I'm being for real. I've actually written down my most perfect vision of my life in the notes of my phone. It's true. I have it. It's like the second note on my phone, because I needed someone else's phone number as the first thing most recently. But like, it's right there, easy for me to access. And it's been helpful for me. It helps keep me centered, frankly. And no matter who we are or what our circumstances, we have choices in our daily lives. Little choices and big choices. We have choices about how we spend our time and what we think about. And these base level things are what form the lives that we live. If we know what we want our life to look like and why we want it to look that way, it helps us make the decisions that we need to get ourselves there. So here's an example of this from my life, because I'm not sure that I was saying that completely clear. I don't see how I can stay in the house that has been our home since we've moved back to Kansas, since my own family structure has changed. And what's sad to me is that my boys are going to lose the house that they have lived in for more than twice as long as they have lived in any other home. They like this house, and they've dealt with a ton of change this year, and I hate to add another major change to their lives. Also, my house has become a safe place for me in the last 7 months. I love it here. I feel protected here. I sit at my kitchen table all day, almost every day, working, and then I dance around my kitchen after the boys come home from school, cooking and doing random projects with them. This place has become a sanctuary of sorts for me and for us. And also, I really enjoy hosting different groups of friends, and this house has allowed that to happen. So I recognize all of these feels in me. There might be some others that I don't recognize yet, but these are the ones that I am aware of and I feel deeply. They are the ones that bring me near to tears whenever I think of having to sell this house. But then I look at the list on my phone, and friends, none of the descriptors of the perfect life unfolding for me need this house. In fact, this house keeps me from some of the most basic things. For instance, I want to be available and accessible for my boys during their school years. I can't see how I would be able to do that if I were still in this house, because I would have to work my hiney off to afford this house. And if I'm working so much, I can't be available and accessible to them. Or I guess I should say, like, I can't see how that would be a possibility right now. So I mean, so what the heck? That makes this decision pretty easy. I should not stay in this house, right? When we are able to step back from the big and little decisions we have to make and think of our choices in relationship to how we feel called to live into our most perfect lives, it makes the decisions less emotionally difficult, I think. When our whys are more clear, our hows become easier, I think. I know that there is a great call to your life, my friends. I'm 100% absolutely positive about it. And there is a great call to my life as well. You are courageous and can do the things you need to do to live into your call. And so am I. Let's be willing to think anew about who we are because of whose we are, and let that guide us in all of our daily decisions. You can do it. I can do it. Thanks be to God. May it be so. I'm Amy Kay, and this has been To Be Fair. Until next time, friends, take good care.